Well, that passage that we read a moment ago, Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, is the passage we're now considering. And really, we could say then that if chapter 1 is the introduction to the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verses 1 to 5 are the introduction to that introduction. Because it's here then that in these verses we're given the real background to the whole story of the book of Ruth, the very starting point to our story. If you like, these verses are the soil out of which will grow this whole story of the book of Ruth. And so for the first part of today's sermon, I want to conduct a bit of a study upon this introduction. I want to observe and describe its features. If you like, I want to examine the soil out of which this story will grow. And for the time being, then, that's all I want to do. I just want to observe and describe what we have here. And only after we've done that, then, will I move on to talk about what this means exactly for us. So let's consider a few features, then, of this introduction. And the first thing I want us to consider is the period. The period. Verse 1 begins, in the days when the judges ruled, or more literally in Hebrew, in the days of the judging of the judges. So already then we're finding ourselves in this book in a particular period in history. We're in the era of the judges, the period of the judges, the same period which is recorded by the book which comes immediately prior to the book of Ruth, the book of Judges. A book which is about that period then before Israel had a king and God instead raised up local political leaders, judges, in order to curb the sin and the idolatry of the people in Israel. Now people criticize the book of Judges, don't they, as a book which is just a bloodbath, a collection of horror stories. Richard Dawkins has said words to that effect. But you see, that is the point of the book of Judges, isn't it? The book of Judges is to demonstrate what Israel shamefully was like during that period. I mean, just cast your eyes back to the final verse of that whole book of Judges, just on the previous page. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That really gets to the heart of what the book of Judges is about. The absence of a king in Israel meant the absence of order, the absence of agreement, the absence of moral restraint. It meant moral confusion in Israel. Worse, it meant moral depravity in Israel, as we see on various occasions in that book. And that then is the period in which the book of Ruth is set. So that's the period. Secondly, I want us to consider the problem. The problem we have in these verses. Well, the problem is, as we read in verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. That's the problem. There was a famine in the land. Now, famine, thankfully, is something that we don't have to worry about very much in this country in these days. But actually, not that long ago, I'm talking about maybe just the 18th century, say, Europe was deeply affected by famine. Famine was not just a problem in third world countries. Famine was a problem worldwide. I've got some figures here. Between the years 1692 and 1694, famine struck France, and about 15% of the population in that year starved to death. In 1695, it struck Estonia. A fifth of the people died. In 1696, it was Finland, and there up to a third of people died. And then over the next couple of years, it was Scotland. And in some places in Scotland, up to 20% of the population died. So we forget our privileges in this day and age. Famines are appalling things and have been appalling things affecting the globe. But while the idea of a famine in Scotland might for us be troubling, here in this passage we see something actually much more troubling. we see a famine in the land of milk and honey, in the land of Israel, in the land of blessing. And that was troubling because the Lord had said back in the book of Deuteronomy that if the people obeyed his law, then famine wasn't something they had to worry about. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 5. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, the Lord had said to the people. If they obeyed God, then blessed was their basket, blessed was their kneading bowl. Deuteronomy 28, verse 11. And the Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of your livestock, and the fruit of your ground, within the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open his good treasury, the heavens, to give rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the works of your hands. That was the promise that the people received for their obedience. So why then are they afflicted by a famine in Ruth? Well, the answer is surely obvious, isn't it? Israel had not been enjoying the Lord's blessing because they have not obeyed him. Instead, they have disobeyed him. And now they're suffering the Lord's curse. If they disobeyed the Lord, he said back in Deuteronomy, then the heavens over your head shall be bronze and the earth under you shall be iron. Deuteronomy 28, verse 23. So, famine. Every famine is grim, but in the land of Israel, in the land of milk and honey, famine meant the curse of God. So that's the problem. We've looked at the period, the problem. And then thirdly, the place, or really the places. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land, and here we come to the place, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. The country of Moab. Now, I suppose one of the things which makes biblical narrative, and in particular the book of Ruth, different to other Bible books, is it doesn't always spell out when someone is in the right and when someone is in the wrong. There'll be times in this book where we just have to suspend our moral judgment and say that the book doesn't speak clearly as to the rights and wrongs of a situation. And the decision then for Elimelech and his family to leave Bethlehem and to move into Moab, I think, is one of those kinds of events. Arguably, Elimelech is actually only doing what his ancestors before him had done. That's what the patriarchs had done. They'd moved to foreign lands in times of famine. We'll talk about that a bit later on. So I don't want to sort of waste time attacking Elimelech this morning, because the Bible doesn't do that. That said, however, you can't help but feel that by leading his family out of Bethlehem and into Moab, Elimelech is doing something which at best is unsatisfactory. I mean, yes, this is an emergency, this is a famine, this is a point in his life where perhaps he thought he had no other option, but Moab, of all places, I mean, Moab, the word alone was enough to make an Israelite skin crawl. This is the nation, Moab, which was conceived when Lot slept with his daughter. This is the nation that employed Balaam, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, to curse Israel in Numbers 22. This is the nation which actually not that long ago, back in Judges chapter 3, had oppressed Israel for 18 years under Fat King Eglon. So to think then that this family is going there during this period of famine, to that land. Whatever our verdict might be of these people, then you can't help but feel there must surely be an element of shame about this. People surely were frowning their eyebrows as Elimelech led his family out of the land. I mean, he's going out of Bethlehem. Bethlehem literally means house of bread. If there was anywhere worth living in Israel in a famine, you'd think it was there. And yet we see this family wandering out of the house of bread in the famine, out of Israel, and into the land of their enemies, into Moab. So, we've looked at the period, we've looked at the problem, we've looked at the place or the places. And then fourthly then, the people. Let's just say a few things about the people. Let's make a few observations about them. So who have we got here in this passage? Well, initially we have Elimelech. He's the leader of this party into Moab. And along with Elimelech goes his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. But of course, in verse 3, Elimelech dies, and Naomi is left a widow, and her boys are left fatherless. So things become pretty bleak for them in the land of Moab. But at that point then, there seems to be a glimmer of hope, because in verse 4, we see that the boys marry. The trouble is, of course, that even at this point, things aren't ideal, because they don't marry Israelites, because they're not in Israel. They marry Moabites, because they're in Moab. And once again, then, our eyebrows are raised. Now, to be clear about this, the law of Israel didn't clearly forbid the marriage to Moabites. Deuteronomy chapter 7 forbids the Israelites to marry the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. That's Deuteronomy chapter 7. But the Moabites aren't mentioned in that list. So strictly speaking, the law doesn't condemn what Elimelech does at this point, but even still, or what Elimelech's children do at this point, but even still, surely it was against the spirit of the law, at the very least, to marry a foreigner, any foreigner, to marry a Moabite. I mean, remember what happened back in the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 25. In the book of Numbers, chapter 25, the people of Israel are seduced. Who are they seduced by? Moabite women. And as a result then, after being seduced by these Moabite women, they end up worshipping the Moabite gods. Baal of Peor. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. So on that occasion then, Moabite women had been a real snare for the Israelite men and had led them into idolatry. Also notice in our passage, in verse 4, it says, these took Moabite wives. Speaking of Mahlon and Chilion, they took Moabite wives. Well, I think it's just worth pointing out that that word took is not the normal word for marrying someone in Hebrew. That word has a more negative, sort of unnatural quality to it. Literally, it means to lift up or to carry a woman. And I draw it to your attention then because it's the same word which is used in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah to describe the marriages between Israelites and non-Israelites. And in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, those marriages are definitely condemned. So again then, the hints are sort of more subtle here, but the overall situation is very uncomfortable, to say the least. These young boys marrying the Moabites. And remember then, Elimelech is ultimately behind all of this. He's the one who's taken them into the land of Moab. And Elimelech's name means, my God is king. Sort of pronounce it Elimelech in the Hebrew. But I suppose you find yourself asking the question, don't you? Does this family really believe this? I mean, is this a man who is trusting that God is king when he leaves the land of God? Were his sons really serving God as their king when they married Moabite women? Well, whatever we think about all of this, we're soon left in a situation where these two Moabite women end up being most of the surviving family. After 10 years of living in Moab, both Mahlon and Chilion die as well. And so the family, they might have come here to escape famine, to escape the curse of God, but of that original family which left Israel, all but Naomi die. And she is now a lonely Israelite in Moab with her two Moabite daughters-in-law. If she wanted to return now, she could, but she'd return, presumably, in a state of shame and barrenness. quite interesting, isn't it, really, that in spite of being married to these two Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah, for 10 years, neither Mahlon nor Chilion produce any offspring for Naomi. She is left barren. She doesn't have children. She doesn't have grandchildren. So anyway, that's a little introduction. That's a little study of this introduction to Ruth. And really, if we're to summarise what we've just said there, this introduction is quite grim, really, isn't it? And all its features are grim. The period in which this book is set is grim, the period of the judges. The problem which is facing them is grim, this famine. The place in which they're living is grim, Moab, the enemies of God. And the people, Elimelech and Naomi, they're living a pretty grim existence also. Elimelech has died, Mahlon and Chilion have died, Naomi is left on her own with her two Moabite daughters-in-law. So, I said we're examining the soil, so to speak, of this introduction. Well, the soil is grim, it's dusty and it's dead and it's hostile to life. And that's our context then, that's our beginning, that's where we're starting in verses 1 to 5. It's a grim introduction. So having now said that then, where do we go from there? Well, I suppose the temptation at this stage would be for me to draw out some moral lessons from what we've considered and to say something to you like, well, don't do what Elimelech did. Don't leave the people of God. Don't leave church. It won't go well with you. Or don't run away from God's discipline or something like that. Or make sure you don't marry non-Christians. I could teach you those sorts of lessons. And they may be true lessons. But I don't think right now it's necessarily appropriate for me to draw out those lessons. I think that would be a pretty thin gruel of a sermon if that's all we could say about this passage. Because thankfully that's not all we can say about this passage. There's more to say about this. There's more in this passage going on than meets the eye, grim though it might look. And so that then brings me to the second part of this sermon this morning. And if you're wanting a heading or a sort of subtitle or something to sort of to go over this second part of the sermon, you could use this one. My heading would be, "All is not as it seems." All is not as it seems. Yes, as we've seen, things look grim. Things seem unpromising. Things seem hopeless. But I want to put it to you now that for the careful Bible reader, for the person who knows the scriptures, even here, even in these first grim five verses of the book of Ruth, there are little clues, little faint indications that all is not as it seems. Even now, at this early stage of the book, there is a faint glow of hope on the horizon. And I want to draw this out to you. All is not as it seems. So why do I say that then? Where's this faint hope? Well, if you've read the book of Genesis before, parts of this passage should seem to you familiar. See, in this passage we have a man, as we say, who's faced with a famine and he's finding shelter in a foreign country. Well, that's not the first time we've seen that in the Bible. We see that happen quite a few times, actually, in the book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 12, Abraham's family are faced with a famine. And what does Abraham do? Well, he goes to a foreign country. He goes to Egypt in Genesis chapter 12. And then a little bit later on, the same thing happens with Isaac, his son. And in Genesis chapter 26, Isaac and his family are faced with a famine. And what does Isaac do? Well, he goes to a foreign country. He goes to the land of the Philistines to shelter from that famine. And then, a little while after that, what happens? Well, there's another famine. And it's a famine facing Jacob and his sons. And at this point, we remember Joseph is in Egypt. And what does Jacob do? Well, he sends his sons to a foreign land to get supplies in their time of famine. He sends them to Egypt. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because on each of those previous three occasions, something remarkable happens. As for Abraham, he leaves Egypt a rich man. In Genesis chapter 13, we're told now that Abraham was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold as a consequence of having gone to the foreign land. As for Isaac going to Philistia, the same thing happens. Genesis 26, verse 13, it says, "The man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him." As for the sons of Jacob going to Egypt, well, it's perhaps not as clear on that occasion, but we know, don't we, that when they settle in Egypt, we read in the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 7, "The people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and they multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." So you see then, we have this theme, we have this pattern. The people of God, they're faced with a famine, they depart to a foreign land, and in that foreign land, God prospers them. Now, why that is the case, I'm not going to necessarily delve into this morning. But I would simply suggest to you that now that we're here in Ruth chapter 1, and we're seeing this family faced with a famine and entering a promised land, grim though it might seem, we can't help but wonder, can we, if there might be a pattern here. That wasn't the end of the road for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. No, it was the beginning of a period of great blessing for them. And so must this be the end of the road for Elimelech's family as well? Well, surely not. Surely there is a faint glow of hope on the horizon. All is not as it seems. And then more than that, and then we consider, you see, the plight of Naomi. And here she is. And we said she at first is widowed. And then after she loses Elimelech, her sons die, having not had children themselves. In a single stroke, then, Naomi loses both her children and all possibility of grandchildren or great-grandchildren or any more generations down the line. It looks like, at this point, Elimelech's family line has been finally snuffed out on the basis of his poor decision to go into Moab. Well, that's as it seems. But once again, we remind ourselves, don't we, that this isn't the first time we've come across a childless lady in Scripture. Again, you look no further than the book of Genesis, and you see Sarah, 90 years old before she gives birth to Abraham's heir, before she gives birth to Isaac. We think of Rebecca, who was also barren. We might forget that, but Rebecca was too barren until Isaac, her husband, prayed that the Lord would open her womb, and in response to that prayer, he does. Rachel, the other patriarch's wife, also barren until the Lord opens her womb and she gives birth to Joseph. And then we go beyond Genesis and we see once again, we think of Hannah. We know it's a little bit later on, but Hannah, the mother of Samuel, without a child, praying before God and God blessing her and answering her barrenness and giving her a child. Or the mother of Samson, once again, a barren woman who gives birth to a child, and not just any old child, but Samson, the great, powerful judge. Once again, then, we see in Scripture this pattern, tried and tested, of the Lord opening the wombs of barren women. Just when it looks like there's no possibility of them having any more children, and that's it, the family line has been snuffed out, and there's no more future for them, right at the very brink of disaster, God answers and opens the womb and brings children into their lives. And so then, we come to Naomi, and again, her situation looks grim. As I say, it looks like Elimelech has just taken her into this foreign land, and he has died and the children have died, and on the basis of this poor decision, they're living under the curse of God. There is now no more hope for Naomi's line. But again, on the basis of what we've seen previously in Scripture, we can't help but hold out hope for her, can we? We can't help but say, surely there is a faint glimmer at the very least of hope in this passage. If God has found a way before, then surely he can find a way again and give Naomi her offspring. All is not as it seems. And so yes, at first sight, the first few verses of the book of Ruth, they look grim. This man and wife living in a stagnant period of history, and then a famine, and then a departure from the promised land, and then he dies, and then the sons marry a couple of non-Israelites, but they don't have any children, then the sons die, and now the wife's stuck, and she's dwindling in this alien land, she's totally isolated, she's been here 10 years, as if she's stuck there, and there's no hope for this family anymore. It's a passage which looks like the final stages of a gradual decline. Deadness and dereliction. And yet, for those of us who know our Bibles and know what God has been like in the past, we see this dead soil trembling with potential, don't we? And we can say God can bring life out of it yet. He can bring riches out of this famine, just like he did for Abraham and Isaac and the sons of Jacob. He can bring fruitfulness out of this barrenness, as he did for Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel. He can bring blessing out of this tragedy. It's almost as if then, as we look upon this wasteland of Ruth chapter 1 verses 1 to 5, there's almost something exciting about it, isn't there? Because it makes you wonder, what's God going to do with this wasteland? Surely all is not as it seems. What's going to happen? Let's watch it attentively and see the new green shoots spring up from the ground and wonder, how is God going to resolve this grim situation? So where is this story going then? How exactly will God bless Naomi? Well, we don't want to spoil this story for ourselves, do we? We've read it many times before, but we want to enjoy watching it again unfolding naturally over the next few weeks. But I think it's enough for now to simply say this, that this book does have an end in sight. God is going to bring life out of this dead soil. And if you want to get to the heart of what this book is all about, just flick forward a couple of pages. And just cast your eyes, not upon the final passage, not upon the final verse, but just simply upon the final word of this book. What's that final word in chapter 4, the very end of this book? David. David, that's what this book is all about. You see, it really comes down to this. This book of Ruth is not here to teach us a few moral lessons. It's not there for us to learn to avoid Elimelech's example or to follow Ruth's example or something like that. No, the real purpose of this book is to pave the way for King David. That's where this story is headed. He's the goal. He is the fresh shoot which will soon break out of this dead soil. The book of Ruth is a story about the royal line of King David. And actually, for us Christians, we don't want to stop there, do we? We can't stop there. Because this same family line which takes us to David, we know it doesn't stop with David. On the contrary, it's the same line which will one day take us further forward than David. It will take us to another king. It will take us to King David's big brother. Indeed, King David's king. The family line, the royal line, will one day arrive at the king of the world himself. Jesus, King Jesus. That's the big storyline of the Bible. That's where the Old Testament is headed, page after page. It's taking us to him. And with every page we turn in the Old Testament, we find ourselves edging closer and closer to the arrival of King David. And so the book of Ruth then, it's here then to tell its own part of that story. It's here to pave the way, yes, for David in the first instance, but even more than that, It's here to pave the way for the Son of David, for Christ himself. And when we realise that, when we realise that this is the real purpose of the book, we can't help but see verses 1 to 5 of chapter 1 in a new light. This story about the royal line, about King David, the line of ultimately Jesus himself, is beginning here, in a place that doesn't look very special, doesn't look very noble, doesn't look very promising at all. You might think, wouldn't you, if you wanted to write a special story about the ancestors of your favourite king, you would claim that your king was descended from the gods, or claim that he was descended from some mighty men. This isn't a very obvious place to start the story, is it? In this grim place, in this bleak place, in this unpromising place, in this place which is morally awkward and involves poor decision-making and Moabites. You wouldn't want to begin your story there. This looks like the beginning of more like the end of a story than a beginning, doesn't it? It looks like the story which is of a family which is slowly fading away in obscurity and shame, as if we've now reached a dead end. And yet the whole purpose of this book is to point out, is to proclaim that it's out of this very barren soil that something amazing is going to shoot up, the royal line of King David. And after that, Christ, the King of the world, Jesus himself, will break out of this dead soil. And as Christians today, as those of us who live not at the period of the Judges, nor of the period of King David, nor even of the period of Jesus, but beyond that, as those who can look back at the full, completed story, we have a wonderful vantage point to read the book of Ruth upon, don't we? We can look back at this passage and we can say, thank God that by his power, the line of David, the line of the Messiah, did emerge from this impossibly grim state of affairs. And not only that, but time and time and time again, whatever the obstacle, however grim it became throughout the period of the Old Testament, the line of the Messiah was preserved by the power of God. We think of David, sort of almost driven out of his own kingdom. We think of the Jewish exile. We think of the point when it looked like Haman was going to destroy the Jews. We think of those hundreds of years of silence and darkness after the end of the Old Testament. We think of Herod trying to kill all of the children in Bethlehem. And yet, on every single occasion, no matter how grim it became, the line of Christ weaved its way through that rocky road of history, around every obstacle and over every trial. And against all the odds, God answered the promise and the Messiah was born. And he completed his mission and he defeated the devil and he released us from slavery. And now we look back upon the whole completed story and we say, he has done it, he has finished it. And now we are free. And so what lessons do we draw out of this for ourselves? Well, briefly then, and very generally, we draw out the lesson that God is powerful, don't we? And even when things seem to be at their wits' end and it looks like there is no way out, God remains powerful and his plans and his promises are never, ever thwarted. Elimelech's name means my God is king. Well, whether Elimelech believed that or not is besides the point. It remains true. Our God is king. He is the king of the universe and nothing in this world is able to resist his power. And he can and he does snatch victories even from the jaws of defeat. But actually, I think there's something even better than that which we can say this morning. Not just that God is powerful, not just that God can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. I think we can say that the God of the Bible is a God who positively delights in snatching victories from the jaws of defeat. I mean that in time and time and time again in Scripture, we see those kinds of situations that I've just mentioned, situations where all hope looks lost. Whether it's Joseph languishing in an Egyptian prison, or the Israelites trapped between the armies of the Egyptians and the Red Sea. And for a time then you think, it is now over. It's mission failed. It's time to pack it in. And we have the same feeling reading the beginning of Ruth. If this was a game of Monopoly we were playing, we'd think, well, now is the time that it's just not worth carrying on. It's over. We've lost the game. And yet, it is almost as if God relishes exactly those kinds of hopeless situations, because it's in those kinds of situations where things look so grim and hopeless that God so loves to act and loves to display his unstoppable power and his unthinkable wisdom. And Joseph then rises up from that prison and into the royal palace, and God miraculously opens the sea and leads the Israelites through and destroys the Egyptians. He snatches victory from the jaws of defeat, and new life comes bursting up from the deadest of soils. And that should be such a source of hope for us this morning. And so I'll just end by saying this. We can't say what God is going to do with the future of this church. It might dwindle. It might fade. That might happen, and that might be the Lord's will for this place. But that is by no means guaranteed. On the contrary, in this church we believe in a God who can and does, and more than that, seems to positively enjoy breathing new life into dying situations. And so that means then that we must trust God, and we must keep on trusting him. And the present circumstances in this church, our size, our age, our financial capabilities, those circumstances do not tie God's hands. He can do whatever he pleases with this church. And so we pray then that he will. He will act. He will do the miracle. He will breathe the new life into this situation. Earlier this year, my dad got me a book about how it's a book about how nature seems to be able to thrive in the most hostile of situations, the most hostile of environments. And there's a chapter in that book about the Battle of Verdun, and talks about how over the course of 300 days, around 40 million shells dropped in a space of 8 square miles of land. How 300,000 people died in that battlefield, and how the landscape then was totally ruined. And shortly after that, then, experts and botanists and people who knew about plants and animals, they looked upon that site and they said, this is just a biological desert. They just assumed that it would never recover from that kind of trauma. Well, the author of this book, she spends a chapter writing about this battlefield of Verdun, and she revisits the site herself, and she describes how much things have changed since then. She writes this, she says, here life lurks in the folds and wrinkles. 15 species of fern jostle for space in the shadows. Time scrambles over dry rock, searching for purchase where the trees found none. Ponds form in the craters in which skulk newts and yellow-bellied toads. Rare orchids arise along the edgelands. Songbirds lift their voice in praise. Vegetation breathes. Here one feels at once the astonishing fortune of living in such a vast and endlessly forgiving world, the beauty of it, the blessed relief. And as we look over our own nation and the churches of our own nation, we might be tempted to think, well, this is it now. We're living in a desert. There is no hope of recovery. It's received blow after blow. Liberalism and rationalism and the sexual revolution and new atheism and postmodernism and all of these different movements sort of bit by bit battering the life out of the church. And what do we have left? We have this barren wasteland and so many empty church buildings and a few little churches like this one holding strong but getting smaller and weaker and older. And we might be tempted to think then, this is it now. But we need to trust that God can do for the church what we see so beautifully happening at the battlefields of Verdun. He can bring new life out of dead soil. And we see him doing it in Ruth chapter 1, or getting ready to do it in Ruth chapter 1. And we must pray then that he would unleash his reviving power on us as well. And we trust that he can. Amen.